there's a lot. It is heavy. And if you're someone who needs to be constantly monitoring these threats and you're personally impacted by these attacks, it's a lot on your body. It's a lot on your mind.
Welcome to the Philanthropy Masterminds podcast, brought to you by DonorSearch, the show that takes you inside the lives of thought leaders, innovators, and changemakers in fundraising, philanthropy, and civil society. I'm your host, Jay Frost. Today, we speak with Madeline Durante, one of four individuals honored with the Outstanding Young Professional Award by the Association for Fundraising Professionals. Madeline serves as Director for Donor Retention and Direct Response at MoveOn, with responsibility for maintaining relationships with over 100,000 of the organization's grassroots sustainers. She is also a board member for the New York Abortion Access Fund, co-leading the organization to 750% revenue growth over the last 3 years alone. We caught up with Madeline at AFP ICON, the Fundraising Association's international conference.
I became involved at MoveOn, which is the United States' largest independent progressive advocacy group. We are a digital-first organization, and we just turned 25. And wow. I got involved with MoveOn because I was really inspired by how I felt like a lot of campaigns were doing fundraising work as a form of community organizing. And it was interesting for me to see the work that, for instance, campaigns such as the Bernie Sanders campaign would do, wherein you get people to give what they can, $5 or $10 each month. And in doing so, you can make big things happen. But I like depth. I didn't want the campaign lifestyle, right, of moving from job to job every few months. I was with Planned Parenthood previously for 5 years, and I just have really enjoyed being able to be closer to the work where I can understand the ins and outs of an organization, build relationships. So what really attracted me to MoveOn is that MoveOn is funded by and for its membership. MoveOn members represent folks from all walks of life across the country who just share a commitment to progressive change towards advancing social justice. And that's where our funding comes from. Like, if you look at a traditional donor pyramid, MoveOn's is quite the opposite, right, you could say. And so at MoveOn, I'm our director for donor retention and direct response, where I am very grateful to be stewarding the experience of our over 100,000 sustainers. And it's really through grassroots sustainers who believe in progressive values and who know that there's always going to be a crisis of the day, right? And MoveOn's rapid response. We always got a campaign going, but it is so cool in the midst of that to be able to support and steward so many donors who are committed to progressive change no matter the season. And I also do our multi-channel fundraising work as a part of that. So helping MoveOn build out, we're traditionally a digital first group, but of course the fundraising landscape is changing. We can't just email people all the time. And so making sure that we're learning more about what other fundraising channels do our donors resonate with? Where do they want to hear from us? What do they hear from us? How can we adapt our messaging for the next quarter century progress?
A quarter century, it's pretty amazing because I remember the first MoveOn campaigns. I'm that age. And I don't know if you would have experienced them personally or not, but maybe for those who aren't familiar with MoveOn, who are not yet on the list, can you talk a little bit about the origin story of MoveOn?
MoveOn is a digital platform, and it was considered the first viral online petition, which happened in the late 90s. And since then, MoveOn really outgrew to become a large resounding voice for the anti-war movement. A lot of folks, I think my first familiarity with MoveOn was going to anti-war protests in the early 2000s with my family. And MoveOn has also built a bench of progressive leadership. Some of the moments that I've been really proud of is we were one of the first organizations of our scale to endorse Bernie Sanders, for instance, really helping build out electing people that we're really excited about and who have a forward-looking and positive vision for what progressive change in this country can look like. And so now MoveOn, this year we are in the midst of a $32 million electoral program. We're targeting what we call surge voters, which is people who voted for the first time or who became active after 2016. And we're using a variety of tactics to because we know that what's on the line in 2024 is the future of democracy itself, and that's not an exaggeration. And we're using our unique role as an independent progressive advocacy group to connect folks to the values that resonate most for them. Because for me, that's ultimately what gets me to show up. I don't think any one politician or figure is going to save us, right? But what I care about is let's work together to advance the values that we need. And so being able to connect with donors and, sorry, potential voters on that level. So used to talking about donors.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because you're focused on these sustainers. Mm-hmm. And 100,000 is a big number. So there's a lot to dig into there about mm-hmm. how you did that, how you're growing that, why that's important. And I want to ask you about those things. But something strikes me about what you just said, which is that these aren't single issue voters any more than they're single donation donors, mm-hmm. that single issue donors. So when an organization is trying to get people fired up about a particular issue or a particular election, that is very, very narrow. Mm-hmm. How have you worked to make sure that people feel like, no, that's just one piece of a broader fabric, and then made them feel like they were part of a larger family of people, not just issues?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's one of the great challenges that we're working on, especially from a supporter retention standpoint. MoveOn, what we are really good at, our bread and butter, is we're excellent at rapid response. That's what we've done throughout the course of our organization's history. You know, previously I worked at Planned Parenthood, and it was really inspiring to see after the overturn of Roe v. Wade in 2022, when that decision was leaked, right away, I believe it was Planned Parenthood, MoveOn, and Women's March partnered to put together hundreds of marches across the country. And so that's the kind of power of a rapid response group. When you talk about donor retention, though, then the question becomes, so many donors gave because they were moved by that specific campaign and that moment of time. And it's important that we honor donor intent and their desire to support the campaigns that mean the most to them during that time, and also, as much as possible, for those donors who are interested in what MoveOn's bread and butter is, which is multi-issue, mm-hmm. progressive organizing with a focus on winning elections, but also just advancing the issues, passing better policies, changing the culture. We want to make sure that for those donors, we're doing a really good job of telling the story of our unique role within the ecosystem.
And that's challenging, right? Because mm-hmm. if an organization focuses on advocacy, mm-hmm. one of the arguments is, well, we need advocacy. Mm-hmm. The other is, well, yeah, but what are you really doing? I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sure you hear some of that pushback even among friendly donors and fellow advocates. Mm-hmm. So how do you help people to stick with you as sustainers when some of them think that they want to do more than just advocate?
Mm-hmm. Something that serves me well is that MoveOn is obsessed with data analysis and impact. We are always testing. We're always striving to really measure the work that we do. I'm working with data scientists for the first time ever, which is really cool. They bring a totally different analysis of things. But, you know, it's interesting for me because I really see when you work at an advocacy and political group at the scale, I've never seen such rigorous focus to listening. And this involves voter listening, both through surveying, putting together panels of voters, to analyzing the behaviors of our membership base to figure out what they're most compelled to do. So I think something that helps is that we are so laser focused on data and analysis that we're really able to tell that story. Also, our donors are awesome. Like, they're lifelong activists. They really right. care about progressive values. They care both about winning elections, but also know that change does not end the day after an election day, right? We need to hold people accountable when we get them into office. We need to push for the better policies that we need across a broad cross-section of issues. And I do think that for those donors who decide that MoveOn is going to be a political space for them to give, they really get that. And it's really inspiring to watch. I was just wrapping up a week of donor listening sessions this week, which normally I don't do. I'm pretty behind the scenes. And, you know, just hearing from folks who say, for instance, like faith leaders, where their conviction to their faith, to social justice, to pacifism is what keeps them in this work for decades. I've never worked with a donor base quite like that before, and I find it tremendously gratifying.
Yeah. It strikes me that there's a huge difference between this and the political campaigns themselves. Even when campaigns are working on these issues, there's often a transactionality about those programs, and with both parties, that it's all the urgency of now, the fierce urgency of now. Give us $3 at this moment. But they haven't built that sustaining component, which lets people feel like they are heard. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that, but also how you not only listen, but how you show that you're listening, because that must be one of the ways that you retain all these donors.
So I would say that we're working on it, to be honest. One of our big North Stars at this point for our fundraising team has been to really be centering relational fundraising, because I do think, you know, that's something I hear from our donors. They open their email box and they're surrounded and inundated with these sometimes bad faith, urgent give now requests. And that's not how we want to be treating folks. And, you know, I think as someone who works in supporter retention, I'm always thinking about every time I've been able to talk face to face with donors, I've been able to learn things. And I felt recommitted to the purpose of being in progressive politics or just progressive advocacy outside of the political space, which is what a lot of my career otherwise is focused on. It can burn you out. It's hard. And when I am able to connect with people and hear their purpose and hear their why, that reminds me of like the deeper purpose of the work that we do as fundraisers. We connect people to their values and their highest aspirations. It's not people buying stuff. It's people putting their faith in for a better world. That's amazing. But in any event, then the challenge is, how do you create that feeling of, it can be so magical to be in a room with people and everyone sees what the vision is and everyone gets it. And when you're speaking to donors at that scale, then the question becomes, how can you then forge that connection? And one really cool campaign I'll speak to is that something that I think a lot of folks don't know about Move On is that we've really focused on resourcing the progressive movement through digital technologies and, whenever possible, making them open source so that other folks can learn from those technologies. Now, I'm not a text expert, but what I do know is we have this peer-to-peer texting program called Spoke. And so every week, our mobile director, we set this up together. So he texts all of our new monthly donors, our new donors, our reactivated donors every week just to say thank you. And that's, we have a texting volunteer program. People want to help out, and I think that's something really common we hear from our donors. Most of them are giving $5 or $10, and they want to help in a lot of ways. This includes financial resources, but it's also not limited to it, and that's another avenue for tremendous opportunity at Move On, right? We have monthly volunteer calls. We have volunteer roles where you can send people text messages letting them know about urgent actions or just thanking them. There are so many ways to get involved, and I really believe we all have a role.
And those are things that happen in political campaigns, but then they usually stop right after, after they either win or lose. And so you're sustaining those activities. It must be really rewarding, not just for you and for your colleagues, but for the donors and volunteers, because otherwise, when a campaign ends, a political campaign ends, you feel sort of adrift.
Right.
And but you're giving them a way to keep rowing, you know, putting their hands on the oars and rowing towards progress.
Yes. And I think it's important to note, too, some donors are only wanting to give during on cycles. And we expect that. That's plan for that. It's okay. We want folks to make the gifts they want when they want to make it. And then we want to thank them and keep them in the fold. But maybe folks won't interact with Move On again until another campaign really piques their interest. And that's fine. So my approach as a fundraiser has been, if someone doesn't want to give to us, like, that's not the best use of our energy. But what is thanking people for their support, letting them know of the impact of their giving, and then making sure for those folks who, if they just had a little bit more information about, hey, what's this group doing when there's not a big election coming up, might be so inclined to give, making sure that that communication stream is really clear. Like, let's focus on the people who have shown up for this work time and time again, and let's learn from them too. Let's take the feedback in that they've given us, really reflect on that, and share it back with them in our communications to them.
You talked earlier on in this conversation about going to demonstrations with your parents. Can you take us back a little bit and talk about that? That's obviously been like a start for you in all this work that you do. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
I just remember from a very young age, you know, my mom was a teacher and librarian, and my dad has always been involved with like local politics. And so it was just always a part of our family that we talked about. And so from a really young age, I was like, okay, something's not right here. But it was also interesting because, so I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, and Wilmington's an interesting spot. A lot more people know where it is now. Back in the day, everyone thought I was just, you know, that Wilmington was just a suburb of Pennsylvania, right? Where I grew up, Wilmington is, it's a very segregated city. It's a Black city. And also I grew up around a lot of mostly other Italian American and Irish American folk, very strong Catholic influence. And, you know, I think since I moved out of Delaware over a decade ago, I feel like I've seen a lot of exciting organizing happen there, like multiracial economic justice organizing that I personally, and maybe this is because of how like my background and my experience living there, did not see growing up. So I think it was really when I got to college, like when I was in high school, like a lot of my friends, they would get sent down on buses to go to the March for Life, which is a giant anti-abortion protest that happens every January. And they got to miss school for it. And if you're a teenager and you're seeing your friends duck out of school to go to DC. So that's the kind of climate that I grew up in. And so while I was progressive for my community standards, it really wasn't, you know, like a lot of folks until I turn 18, move out, go to college, and I started working in what was then called my campus's Women's Center. They've since changed the name, which is excellent. We put an asterisk in it, which I think is really like early gesturing of like trans inclusivity, but really was not fully there. And that was like my favorite part of school. Was working in our Women's Center. It's where I started really thinking about what it meant to work in a collective and the benefits of working in a collective. I think that I had been sold when I was younger in this idea of this amazing charismatic leader out there. And then you work in a group and you realize like there's so much brilliance that you is out there that is separate from us. And if you're in a group that trusts one another and that actually values lots of different approaches and lived experiences, you can do such amazing work. And so I credit that with a lot of how I ended up the way that I was. And we were holding these 24/7 sexual assault and domestic violence helplines at the time. And we were students, we were peers, we were trained, but it was a heavy responsibility to hold. And I think it kind of burned me out in some ways because there was a certain moment, I think doing anti-violence, anti-sexual violence work on campus, this is like, if people say the 2010s, I don't know, it was the early 2010s. But through that, I started going to a reproductive justice conference, and reproductive justice, as I imagine many of you are familiar, is a political analysis started by Black women that determines the right to have a child, to not have a child, and to parent a child in healthy and thriving communities. And I think that was a wake-up call for me where I started thinking about working on this helpline. I'd always been thinking about the things we fight against, like, let's support our fellow students, let's support each other against, like, sexual violence, etc. It really pushed me to think about what are we fighting for, and to imagine that better world where people can access healthcare, including abortion, where moms can parent their children in communities and not be afraid of police violence, where people can have access to safe, clean drinking water. Being able to draw the dots and not just always be fighting back against something, but fighting forward. So from there, I'm not, this is long, I'm sorry, I'm not like other, something just weird is through that. I saw these really interesting groups at this conference, just looking at abortion funds, bail funds, like really interesting radical groups, and they were all struggling to raise money. And I had been just like trying to think about. I was also getting politicized, like, as the movement for Black Lives was coming up, and I was really trying to think about, like, as a white person on the left, what is like a place for me to support the movement while being in right relationship. And I felt like back in fundraising, redistributing resources, moving them in service of justice, it seemed like a space where I knew I liked talking to people, I liked writing, and it just seemed like a good fit. And so from there, I really started in fundraising right after college and started at Planned Parenthood and never looked back.
I really appreciate the arc of that story and the way you described about moving from fighting against to fighting for. I think it's something that obviously a lot of people can resonate with, but also finding how you could be an instrument of aid to all these other people in a community. And I'm wondering, as you look forward now, we're looking at a very challenging year. You're working on it every day and move on. And I'm not asking for political prediction, but I am curious about whether you are hopeful, and if so, how you sustain that hope when we're buffeted by lots of different information, some of it quite negative, some of it a lot of these things we fight against when you're trying to fight for.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate that question. It's something that, as I gave my remarks today, I was very much reflecting on, because I think with all of the crises of the world that we're encountering right now, with systemic anti-Black racism, with colonialism, extreme income and wealth inequality, gender-based violence, white Christian nationalism, like, there's a lot. It is heavy. And if you're someone who needs to be constantly monitoring these threats and you're personally impacted by these attacks, it's a lot on your body. It's a lot on your mind. And yet, I just really believe that because this work is so important, we cannot afford to dispense in pessimism. I think it's fundamentally hopeful to try to mobilize resources for a better world. And in doing so, we must have that vision for what it looks and feels like. And I think that you often find it by looking at the micro level. And so, you know, at my work, I work at more large scale groups. In my personal life, I've often helped organize the small groups. And I think that both have so much to learn from each other. I want a big, powerful left that doesn't cede any lane of power and that helps protect our fundamental rights and create a better future for all of us. And when I think about how we get there, I often find inspiration on the hyper-local level. I just off-boarded from New York's abortion fund, the New York Abortion Access Fund. I served on its board for 4 years and just finished my service. And at NIAF, that's the work I think about when I think about how fundraising can be a hopeful practice in building a better world, because what we were doing when I started, we were a collective of just a few volunteers, and we were mobilizing several $100,000, around $200,000 each year, to New Yorkers, to people traveling to New York to help them pay for their abortions. And now NIAF has a budget of $2 million, a staff of three, and is moving $2 million each year to people seeking abortion, to people who are most impacted by abortion bans, barriers, and restrictions, to New Yorkers, and to the increasing number of people traveling to New York for care. Last year, I believe just under a third of funding was allocated to people traveling from out of state, Texas, Florida, Georgia. Folks haven't stopped getting abortions. Those don't go away. You just have to travel for care. It's more expensive. But what gives me hope about that, right, is like our systems are failing so many people. They're failing folks who need abortions. And we're helping create systems of care and solidarity and mutual support to fill in those gaps and to imagine a better world. So we're putting into practice that idea of collective care.
One of the things I'm marveling at as you talk about this is that you also have a language for it. And no, I, because not everybody's talking about these issues. And I wonder if sometimes it's because we're all come to these things with different levels of awareness.
Yeah.
But as we become aware, we don't always have a language for talking about them. And when did you find, and how did you find the language to talk about these ideas in ways that are not just clear and understandable, but also motivating for people who might have a heart for these issues, but are struggling to find their place in them?
Well, honestly, I would say that the heart comes first. I think the heart comes before the head. And where I have made the most mistakes is putting the head before the heart. Like, I was absolutely that kid who gets politicized at college, like the kid with class privilege who goes to liberal arts college to get politicized with, to begin with, and is living in the environmental collective home and trying to pretend like I don't come from the privileges I do, right? Like, that was absolutely me. And I would come home and be like, Mom, Dad, have you read Frantz Fanon? And that doesn't work with people. If you start with the head, you are getting nowhere. So I actually think if I could give myself like a decade ago notes, it would be to start with the heart, not the head, because people, I really believe that when we think about, how do I say this? I believe we are meant to look out for one another, and most people possess within them a deep care for the common good, deep empathy. When we are able to see one another in our full humanity, I think we want us all to thrive. I think we know that each individual is the expert in their own lives, and that communities who are most impacted by issues have the best ideas, because we experience that on the micro level all the time, right? Like, if, you know, if your comms person tells your data person how to do their job, there's going to be a problem. So I think we know these things in our heart. And I sometimes just, you know, my mom is a librarian. I was always kind of a bookish child, but you need the heart, you need the practice, you need the trying and humility. So I actually would say, I don't think the words necessarily, like, I don't know that they always do the most good, because if you don't feel it in your heart, if you aren't in real relationship with people, that's where I think talking about justice, like, it can fail. Like, if you don't have real principled relationships with people, then you want to feel in your heart before your head. So, yeah, I would say to that, I'm team heart before head.
No, I love that. I also love that you are giving yourself notes from 10 years ago. So I'm going to ask you a tougher question. What would the notes you'd be to give yourself 10 years from now? Because sometimes as we go through all these experiences, we want to remember something. What's the note you'd give your future self?
That's a really good question, and it's not one that I've really reflected on. And I wonder if some of it is, you know, it's interesting receiving this award as an emerging or young fundraising leader, because I feel like I've frankly spent most of at least the past 5 years in the workplace trying to pretend I'm at least 5 to 10 years older than I am. And so, but I think at the same time, our society is so youth obsessed, right? And so there's this, Nicole Hannah Jones made this joke at the keynote today about going from a young professional to the old professional within a year. And I do think there's a grain of truth to that, insofar as age is a game you can never really win. And there's very little time where you can be read as a human and not as, you know, by virtue of your age or any of the other things that structure how you walk through the world. So, but I think that does mean sometimes thinking about, like, what does it mean to get older, to age as a professional, as, you know, myself with all the identities I bring. It's not something I've given as much reflection to. And I think some of it too is that I just frankly didn't expect to be here, right? Like, there's so many people who deserve their flowers, and I think so many nonprofit workers and community organizers and unpaid volunteers, they're working so hard and deserve to be in these spaces. And I just would never assume that I would be here. And so I think that's part of it too. Like, I'm so happy with the opportunities that I've had. It's so meaningful to be able to, for my job, be able to do something that aligns with my values. That's also a privilege that a lot of folks don't get to have. But because of that, it's a bit, honestly, it's a bit hard for me to imagine what's next.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Philanthropy Masterminds podcast. Thanks very much to our sponsor, DonorSearch, the world leader in fundraising intelligence, and of course our producer, Jack Frost. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, the DonorSearch YouTube channel, or wherever you like to listen. And consider giving us a like and a positive review so others can find us too. Check out our live webinars and webcasts on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and come back next Friday for our next interview with another leader in the world of social good. Until then, this is Jay Frost. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.